Constable Krusty Butt's Loathly Worm. Teddy loved the train. He liked the sooty, masculine smells, and the hissing of the steam engines, and the clang, clang, clang of the bells as the train lurched into the station. He liked the soft, worn leather of the seats, and the patterns of sun that slanted across them, and how the countryside blurred into blues and greens through the open window, and how everything seemed like a grand adventure, just because you were on a train. He especially liked the train at night, when the blues and greens muted to blackness, and the windows were pulled closed and curtains drawn. Thick woolen blankets and great mugs of cider were passed out to the passengers, and the crowd waited expectantly until a flood of bright white stars burst forth on the ceiling. Whenever Teddy and his father had a day out together, they rode on the night train home. And after the cider was drunk and the ceiling stars appeared, he would cuddle up in his father's arms and they would talk about anything and everything and laugh and doze. His father would say things like, "I love you more than anything in the world." And Teddy would feel as happy as a big red balloon, bobbing and dancing in a wide blue sky.
"That will never happen again,"
Teddy thought as he and Tony boarded the train, and something heavy like a fist clenched up and squeezed inside his stomach. Tony seemed entirely oblivious to his young companion's sorrows as he strutted down the corridor of the empty compartment, waving his hands about in a lordly manner, which made Teddy want to kick him. "Some wine, if you please," he shouted at the 18 vacant seats. "And do be quick about it. I must have refreshments as well. I've not eaten a single morsel since breakfast, and my pitiful throat is unbearably raw and parched. It is scorched and ulcerated, and it pains me beyond mortal endurance." He dropped himself into a haughty heap in a window seat, his arms folded angrily against his thin chest, and stared at Teddy in an accusatory fashion. "I tell you, I am simply famished. I am so entirely ravenous and racked with pangs of hunger. I believe I shall soon die of starvation."
"But you have eaten since breakfast, Tony,"
Teddy replied triumphantly as he stuffed his satchel beneath his seat.
"You had that
Tony immediately clapped his hand across Teddy's mouth, and Teddy promptly bit him.
"Oh! You wretched, horrid little beast! How dare you attack me in this vicious manner, you vile spawn of shapeshifters! Do not ever, never speak aloud of that subject again!"
Teddy started giggling furiously.
"Spawn of shapeshifters?"
he repeated merrily.
"That is funny, Tony."
"It was not meant to be humorous," Tony responded in a petulant manner. "There is nothing amusing about anything that has happened to me today. God in heaven, would that I have died before my eyes opened upon the morning sun."
A spectral woman in flowing black garments, her bare feet hovering several inches from the floor, breezed into the compartment, accompanied by a satyr with butterscotch fur and curly horns, and both of them sat down quickly, very quickly, and as far from Tony as was possible.
"You hardly even sleep anyway,"
Teddy said sulkily, glancing briefly at a muscular bald man carrying a 10-foot pike who sat down across the corridor from them.
"You barely sleep an hour a night, and Dad said that is just dead creepy."
"Oh, creepy, is it? I imagine prowling about at night, searching for flesh to devour, and then lolling indolently in one's bed until 9 in the morning is considered normal," Tony howled triumphantly.
"My dad doesn't devour anybody's flesh,"
Teddy shouted and sprang up onto his seat.
"If he is out late, he is just walking in the woods. I do not like you anymore, Tony. I know that you drank wine, that you have ate, well, you've had a rubbish day, so I've been trying to be patient with you, but I'm done with it, and I'm done with you, and I want to kill you."
A tall young man leading a pet iguana on a string sat himself beside the muscular man with the pike, both of them staring openly at the scene.
"Well, that is fine! That is fine!" Tony wailed and burst into racking, guttural sobs. "I am not surprised. No, I am not the slightest bit shocked that you should turn against me after all that I've done for you. Yes, I have done it all. I have changed your nappies and suckled you with bottles and trundled you about the streets of Soho in a muggle pram so that your father might have 2 hours of uninterrupted sleep. I have done it all. and it has not been easy. Have you ever attempted to push a pram up Berwick Street? There was a pause as Tony caught his breath and mopped his streaming eyes with his sleeve.
No,
Teddy responded sullenly. I have played innumerable and insufferably tedious games with those horrid plastic dinosaurs simply for your diversion. And should I live another 1,000 years, I shall never wish to see one more toy dinosaur. Yes, I tell you, I would willingly play Mr. Tippletoe Goes to Market with Cyril Rawbone in the midst of an ice-cold torrential downpour of rain rather than pick up one more pestilent godforsaken dinosaur! A pair of pretty girls in bright green cardigans and flowered dresses scurried past Tony and Teddy's aisle and wedged themselves beside a scowling goblin in a purple velvet suit.
Somebody will have to sit with us when there are no more other seats,
Teddy thought darkly.
This is so embarrassing. Why did I go with him? I'm very tired of your voice, Tony,
Teddy hissed loudly.
Can't you behave properly? And whatever is a Mr. Tippletoe Goes to Market? That does not sound like a fun game at all.
Well, Tony sniffed, momentarily distracted by memories. I'm certain, and my darling Benji would agree with you, were he with us today. But he is not. No, that lovely, kind, precious boy is dead and forever gone. I tell you, life is naught but meaningless toil and misery, endured beneath the angry eyes of a wrathful god, he shrilled out and trembled violently. A luminous skeleton drifted above Teddy's head, stretched out lazily in a horizontal position, and paused to clank and rattle his bones in an obvious attempt to scare him.
Why are you on this train?
Teddy demanded and glared up at the ghost.
Ghosts are meant to stay in the place where they died.
Yes, yes, thank you very much, the spectral figure responded in an offended tone. I certainly wouldn't have known it. I am the ghost of Cluckfield Manor. Teddy looked back at him blankly. Cluckfield Manor, you know, that enormous chicken farm in Buckinghamshire that burned to the ground today. Every single chicken was lost, the skeletal ghost informed Teddy in a pleased voice. Thus, my tether to the accursed edifice had been removed. You may call me the Clattering Bones.
I'm not calling you anything,
Teddy said impatiently.
I'm not allowed to talk to dead strangers. And if that old manor burned down, then maybe you ought to go on. You know, go on to the afterlife.
I would rather go to Brighton. Teddy frowned as he pondered the fate of the poor chickens.
I wonder why a parcel mouth can talk to snakes, but nobody talks to chickens,
he said to the ghost and glanced over at his moaning, sobbing companion.
Why aren't there any poultry mouths, Tony?
Oh, who would care? Tony shouted wildly as he quivered and shook in his seat. Do go away, skeletal thingy. I find you most frightful and I simply abhor chickens. The ghost gave a few more feeble clanks before drifting away, and Tony turned back to Teddy. Chickens! That is what you are concerned about. Chickens? Oh, what a careless and unkind child you are, to be fretting over chickens, whilst I, your tirelessly devoted friend, am moments away from dropping dead of famine right here on this horrendously outdated floral pattern faux chintz-covered seat, to think that I should die on such upholstery as that. It is all so unfair. And when at last I do succumb and breathe my last, I have no doubt that not a single soul will take the slightest notice whatsoever, he screamed maniacally and beat upon his breast like a savage.
I am traveling with Aunt Loretta,
Teddy thought grimly as he slouched down sullenly in his seat.
I am trapped on a train with a person exactly like Aunt Loretta, only whinier and girlier and a whole lot louder. I would notice if you were dead, Tony,
he responded sweetly.
I would notice all the lovely peace and quiet if you were dead.
Tony howled and began banging his head against the window, just as an older man wearing a gray silk top hat trimmed in cream-colored velvet roses dropped exultantly into the seat beside Teddy. "My, that was close," he exhaled, mopping his brow with a lace handkerchief. "Thought the train was full, I did. Bit of luck, that." His voice cut off abruptly as he took in the sight of Tony, who stopped the headbanging and peered at him through bleary reddened eyes. "What do we care of your troubles, sir?" he inquired petulantly. "Why, I tell you, I care nothing for them. Where is the nourishment for which my throbbing belly burns? Where is the wretched trolley wench with our refreshments?"
"He's being very rude because he drank lots of wine," Teddy informed the startled man wearily. "And because he did something bad and disgusting today. I'm sorry you had to sit by us."
He yawned, overcome with a sudden longing for his feather-stuffed mattress and soft cotton sheets and pillow. "Whoa!" the man cleared his throat, apparently uncertain as to what he should say.
"Well, these things happen, I suppose. Yes, well, I'm Mr. Sneedlesnock."
"I'm pleased to meet you, Mr. Sneedlesnock,"
Tully said formally.
"My name is Teddy Lupin, and this is Antonin Grinnell, and he is pleased to meet you too, aren't you, Tony?"
Teddy dug an elbow into Tony's ribs, and Tony gazed at them both with a mournful and somewhat dazed expression.
Yes, certainly. Stars above, why did I drink that accursed wine? I ought never to have done it. I do believe it is wearing off, however. It's just that I simply had to do something to forget. To forget that I..."
His face was a study in wretchedness.
"It's okay, Tony,"
Teddy said and put a small hand on his arm.
"It doesn't matter to me. You are still my friend."
Tony gulped and embraced Teddy enthusiastically.
"My darling Teddy, oh my dearest little plum pudding, how passionately I adore you. Why, you are..."
"And I will cheer you up, Tony,"
Teddy interrupted as he pulled a tattered red velvet book from his knapsack.
"Look what I've brought."
Oh heavens, oh no, oh not that again, please. Any book but that will do. I have told your father 1,000 times that is an extremely terrible and inappropriate book, and I do not know why he allows you to read it."
"He allows me to read it because he likes it too," Teddy said with satisfaction. "Do you mind if I read my book, Mr. Sneedlesnock?"
"Why, not at all, young man," the gentleman said firmly. "I work as a librarian in Lewis. I'm quite happy to encourage young persons to read."
Teddy beamed at him and leapt to his feet, waving the book excitedly in the air.
"All right, everybody, listen up."
All conversation within the train stopped immediately.
"Everyone will love this book,"
he shouted enthusiastically, and 14 heads, even the bald man with the pike, nodded in obedient agreement.
"This is the most excellent book that you will ever hear in your whole entire life, and I am going to read it to you, which I can do very well because I have had lots and lots of practice. My dad reads it best, but he's busy killing vampires. Is everybody ready? Good. And now for Constable Krusty Butt's Lonely Worm."
An expectant hush fell over the group, and Teddy flipped open a page.
"One day, long ago, when your great-grandfather was 3 years old, a small boy named Gronad Krusty Butts went on holiday with his parents to Bavaria. While they were camping and hiking and singing under the stars, a fuzzy little red worm wiggled up Gronad's leg and began singing along with them in a very sweet voice. Gronad loved the worm and begged his parents to let him keep it, and because it was so small and sweet and fuzzy, they said that he could. What Gronad and his parents did not know was that the worm was only 5 days old. It grew bigger and bigger and bigger until it was far bigger than any worm should ever be. It was 15 feet long and wider than two men, and it shed its fuzzy skin and grew a tough, shiny hide like a snake's instead. Even that might have been all right if it had been a nice worm, but it was not. It became very loud and bossy and selfish and did whatever it pleased. It stretched out upon the entire sofa every evening after dinner and did not feel badly about Gronad and his parents sitting uncomfortably on their little straight back chairs. Gronad's father did not like the worm at all now, and his mother said she simply loathed it. She said this so many times that Gronad stopped calling the word fuzzykins and started calling it loathly instead. His parents tried giving the loathly worm away to the zoo, and then the magical menagerie, and they even took out an advert in the Daily Prophet, and you know how costly that is, but nobody would have it. Gronad went to constabulary school, which he finished when he was 19. And the day after he finished, his parents took all his things and crammed them into 3 suitcases and piled them up outside the front door along with the loathly worm and told Gronad that it was time for him to be independent. They did not actually care if Gronad was independent, really. They just wanted him to take that giant loathly worm far, far away, so they would never have to see it again.
Teddy glanced up from the book.
My dad once hunted down a gargantuan mutant worm in Armenia that ate a whole village, not all at the same time. It ate 3 or 4 people a day.
There was a satisfying gasp from somewhere in the compartment.
My dad killed that worm, and do you know what happened when it died?
He looked at the man sitting beside him.
Well, I cannot imagine, the man said kindly, but I'm most anxious to know.
He pooped,
Teddy squealed happily.
Lots of times when people die, they poop a whole lot. Everything that is in their guts comes out all at once.
Yes, well, why don't we return to the book? Mr. Sneedlesnark said quickly.
All right. The ministry sent the new constable to the town of Sorry in the Vale in Cornwall with some money his grandmother gave him. Gronad bought a little orange house at the end of a tiny crooked lane. Sorry in the Vale was a nice town, and there were not any bad people living there, so the constable did not have to do much except walk around the high street and rescue kittens from trees, or tell teenagers not to ride their brooms inside a shop, or tell loud drunk men at the pub it was time to get a move on. Inside the constable's orange house were 4 rooms. A room for the loathly worm, a room for the constable, a kitchen, and a sitting room. There was also a tiny loo with a basin and a toilet, but the loathly worm could not fit in there, and he did not brush his teeth or floss anyway. The constable and the loathly worm got on pretty well for their orange house in Sorry in the Vale. The constable was an easygoing sort of person who tried to get along with everybody, and he appreciated the loathly worm doing the cooking. The loathly worm liked cooking, and he liked doing what he wanted, and he did not mind the constable since the constable did not bother him. That was all very good, until the morning the constable got an owl from his boss, a senior MLE officer named Pontius Pimply Pumps. Officer Pimply Pumps wrote him that a great, big, shiny red worm had been sighted roaming the countryside and had eaten 3 people, and that furthermore the officer had on good authority that Constable Krusty Butts was the owner of this terrible, horrible worm. Officer Pimply Pump said the mystery would not tolerate this, and the constable had better take care of it, because this was not the way the pet of a constable should behave. I say now, the constable grumbled to the loathly worm after he finished reading the owl. I know you've been roaming the countryside, eating people. This is not the way the pet of a constable should behave. You must stop it at once. The constable had never talked to the loathly worm like that before, and the worm could hardly believe it, especially since he had just cooked him this nice breakfast of buttered toast and bread pudding and beans and pickled eggs. He was extremely offended and slithered out of the house without saying a single word to the constable. He wasn't offended that the constable thought he'd eaten 3 people, because he had eaten the 3 people, and even more that the ministry did not know about. He was offended because the constable was trying to tell him what to do. And since he was upset, he decided to visit his best friend, Cyril Van Troll. Cyril Van Troll was the postmaster of Sorien the Vale, and he was a very good friend to the Loathly Worm, but he was not nice to anybody else. Cyril might have acted better if people had been kinder to him, but mostly they're not, because he was a three-eyed troll who had been bitten by a vampire when he was 8 years old. After that, he was pale and undead and 10 feet tall and very sulky, and nobody wanted to play with him at all. Cyril and the Loathly Worm became friends on a Wednesday when they both happened to be going towards the market at the same time. Up ahead of them was a very bad sight, an old man whose legs had been blasted off during one of the Goblin Wars. This poor fellow had 2 wooden poles strapped to his thigh stumps, with Muggle trainers attached to the bottoms of them, and he was tottering and teetering and falling about as he tried to get down the street. Many of the people in the village were trying to help him, and somebody brought out a cart. But the Loathly Worm just yelled out, "Peg legs!" which was a very rude thing for him to do. Cyril Van Troll thought it was the funniest thing he had ever heard, however, and he laughed and laughed, and soon he and the Loathly Worm were laughing and talking together. It is not hard to make friends with people who you think are funny. And once they started talking, the Loathly Worm and Cyril Van Troll discovered they had a lot in common. They both like butterbeer. Oh, so do I. Oh, sorry. And scaring people and pictures of lady elves on the clothes and singing out loud in public. Cyril did not care that the Loathly Worm was ginormous and scaly and disgusting to look at. And the Loathly Worm did not care that Cyril Van Troll was 10 feet tall and pale and undead and had 3 eyes. You might be wondering where that third eye was, if you are the curious sort, but you will have to guess. I dare not tell you.
Teddy held the book in the air and swiveled slowly in a wide arc so that everyone aboard the train could clearly read the scrawled words, "On his bum," scribbled across the top of the page.
My Aunt Rihanna wrote that,
he informed the group proudly.
My dad told me I had a lovely little sister who could write poems when she was 3 and pin sweet notes on my cloak that said things like, "I love my brother the best, and my brother is the bravest boy in the world. But do you think I've got any of those poems or notes that she wrote to remember her by? I do not. All I have left in her handwriting is 3 words that say, 'On his bum.'"
A squat little witch in a polka-dotted robes appeared with the refreshment trolley, and Tony snatched up 6 scandalously sugary scones, 3 boxes of double chocolate singing Jaffa cakes, 4 packages of most salted preening pretzels, and 8 Dementor-worthy chocolate bars, all of which he washed down with 2 decanters of blood-replenishing potion in less than 3 minutes.
Ahem!
The trolley witch broke in and glared at Tony, who was licking his fingers with a beatific expression.
"That'll be 29 galleons, if you please."
"Oh, why, yes, certainly, my little treacle bottom," Tony gushed as he counted out the coins. "I do apologize. I must say you offer quite tasty treats, and with such stellar service as well."
The old witch merely snorted and went on, and Teddy returned to his reading.
The Loathly Worm told Cyril what the constable had said, and Cyril was very indignant. He promised the Loathly Worm he would spend all day with him, and then they would think of what to do. That cheered the Loathly Worm right up. He gave Cyril a big squeeze from his nasty, scaly body, but Cyril did not mind. And then they were off, roaming the countryside, scaring people, laughing and telling silly jokes, and sometimes singing funny songs. Soon they happened upon a very interesting sight. A lovely wedding was taking place near Lover's Lake. The bride wore purple velvet and stood under a canopy of singing butterflies, and her maids wore green with white satin sashes, and the groom sported a stunning indigo frock coat of the finest silk, which his mother had spent 1.5 years sewing by hand. He had blonde hair and blue eyes and was tall and kind like Prince Charming, and the bride was sweet and funny and a sort of girl you'd want to be your friend. The vicar was the bride's father, and he loved her so dearly because she was his only daughter, and he had to stop and wipe his eyes now and then during the ceremony. Cyril and the Loathly Worm watched from behind a barn until the ceremony was over, and everyone began hugging everyone else and saying, "Isn't it wonderful? And aren't they too lovely?" And that was when Cyril Vamptro and the Loathly Worm barged right in. They knocked over tables and tore down the white canopies and pelted the guests with wedding cake and ate all the wedding cake, while the guests screamed and ran about and tried to shout spells at them. That made Cyril Vamptro so angry he spat into the punch, and the Loathly Worm opened his great big mouth and ate the bride.
Gasps of horror rang out inside the train, and one of the pretty girls burst into tears.
They got bored after that, so they had a sit down and a picnic, and then walked a few more miles until they saw a farmhouse with a big blue barn. The doors of the barn were open, and 6 little girls and 10 parents were inside the barn, around a big table draped in yellow cloth, and above them were twinkly yellow fairy lights and yellow sparklers and dancing confetti and singing satin ribbons, for it was one of the little girls' birthday party, and she was 5 years old. The worm's belly was full of bride, and Cyril was full of wedding cake and picnic, so they did not eat any cake, but ripped up all the beautiful satin ribbons and stomped on them to make the little girls cry. One of the parents shouted, "Just who do you think you are?" And someone else said, "Call up the MLE." Well, when they said that, it reminded the Loathly Worm of Senior MLE Officer Pimply Pumps writing Constable Krusty Butts, and how Constable Krusty Butts had not taken up for him at all, but fussed at him as if he were a child. And the Loathly Worm was so angry that even though he was not even hungry, he snatched up the birthday girl in his jaws and ate her in 3 great big crunches. You might think that the Loathly Worm and Cyril Vamptro would be awfully sorry after doing such very bad things, but they were not sorry, not even the slightest bit. In fact, they were so happy they chased each other back to the Loathly Worm's house, laughing and laughing until their guts were sore. When they reached the constable's house, it was supper time, and the constable was in the kitchen. He was not happy at all. He had just received an owl about a bride being eaten on her wedding day this morning, and he knew exactly who had done it. And then Cyril Vamptro and the Loathly Worm came bursting in through the front door, smiling and laughing, as happy as you please. He shouted at the Loathly Worm at the very top of his voice. He said, "There will be no more roaming about the countryside eating people, I tell you. No, never again." Just like you might imagine, that put a stop to all the happiness. Cyril kicked the constable's side table, and the Loathly Worm snapped his tail and turned over the sofa. Then he looked at Cyril and said, "Cyril, I cannot eat him. I'm so full of bride and that podgy little girl and all the cake I've eaten that I will vomit if anything else goes in my stomach. And you know I hate to vomit, Cyril. Can you eat him?"
"No," Cyril told his friend sadly. "I have a big stomach, but that is not that big. I could eat a baby, but nothing bigger than that. But I can kill him for you."
The Loathly Worm let out a great whoop of joy. "You are the bestest friend anybody ever had," he yelled ecstatically. "Do it! Do it! Kill him! Kill him!" The constable was not a coward, though, and he was not afraid. He got out his wand and pointed it right at Cyril's face and said, "Avada Kedavra." But the Loathly Worm knocked him right off his feet. Constable Krusty Butts fell to the floor, and Cyril rushed over with all the force of his huge, muscly leg that was the size of a man, and he stomped on Constable Krusty Butts' head and crushed it. They knew the constable was definitely dead, because his brains were leaking out all over the floor. This made Cyril and the Loathly Worm positively ecstatic. They started jumping and then dancing because they loved to dance. And then they ran outside to sing their favorite song because they also loved to sing. They sang and they danced, and all the neighborhood came to watch them. And this was their song.
Teddy put the book down, cleared his throat loudly, and belted out the song from memory.
Today is a party for you and me, and we shall eat kittens and puppies with glee. We will gulp sweeties and meaties and crumpets and bake out some brownies from African strumpets. We'll boil their black boobies and grind up their bones. We'll broil up their buttocks and serve them with scones. We'll party with birthday boys, brides and their grannies and dish up a baby tart sprinkle with nannies. We'll yank out their teeth and make toppings for pies and saute their bellies and stir fry their thighs. Yes, today is a party for you and me, for we are the bestest of friends we can be.
Teddy clapped the book shut with a dramatic bang, and an explosion of applause, whoops, and clapping rang out around the compartment.
Boobies with breasts,
Teddy hollered, reluctant to lose his audience.
Lady Breast, I've accidentally seen Lady Breast before, but I cannot tell you who's or how. That would not be Chilvrous, and Gryffindors are Chilvrous. I saw those breasts, but I have never seen,
he waited out a dramatic pause,
a lady's other thing.
Oh, no, Teddy, do not speak of, Tony blurted out desperately.
What I mean by her other thing,
Teddy continued doggedly,
is the special personal place that is between her legs.
Oh, heavens, Tony moaned and buried his head in his hands. Perhaps it's best you not, Mr. Sneedle Snark began.
My dad bought me a book about X-S-E-X last year, and we read it together so he could explain things to me. And that is how I learned about the special personal place that girls have between their legs. I asked Dad, is it really a special personal place? Or is the book just saying that to be nice to girls and ladies? And he said, yes, it is definitely a special personal place. In fact, it is an extremely special, personal, magically delicious space.
The crowd howled with laughter.
I know! Dad is very funny before full moon. So I asked my friend Rosie if I could see her special, personal, magically delicious place. And she said, ew, no, what is wrong with you? And then I started crying and I said, I just wanted to see what one looked like, Rosie. I've never even ever seen one. And then she felt very badly and told me not to worry about it. She did not feel badly enough to let me see it.
He scowled.
Have you seen the special, personal, magically delicious place, Tony?
Yes, I have seen one, Tony shuddered. They're simply repellent. A nasty, slippery, slimy thing.
A panicked expression suddenly crossed his face.
Oh my, I never should have said such an inappropriate, oh my, and derogatory and shameful thing. Oh, whatever was I thinking? I despise those bellicose, bitchy little queens who denigrate women, and now I've spoken just like them, he wailed. Your father should never be able to let me spend time with you and Elizabeth. Oh, my darling Elizabeth, my lovely, winsome, captivating new friend. Why, she shall never utter another word to me again. I cannot bear it. I must.
He fumbled in his vest pocket and awkwardly pulled out his wand, waving in an effeminate manner at Teddy's confused face.
Obliviate. There, I'm dreadfully sorry, Teddy, but I said something I should not have, and I simply cannot have you repeat it to your father.
Tony, I still remember everything,
Teddy said in an exasperated voice.
You didn't say the spell properly, and your hand motions weren't right either. You can't let your wrist flop about like that.
What do you know?
Tony responded peevishly, and Teddy's hair flashed a brilliant scarlet orange.
I know that this is how you do it,
he yelled and drew his wand, snapping it smartly at Tony's startled face.
Oblivio!
Tony blinked twice and jumped visibly.
Wherever are we? Stars above, we are on a train, and it is night!
Did you see how fast he whipped out his wand?
The pretty young blonde screeched and bounced in her seat.
That's bloody amazing, isn't it?
You're actually too young to be carrying a real wand,
Teddy's seatmate reproved him gently.
My dad gave it to me to protect Elizabeth and Annie,
Teddy sniffed.
To protect me in case he ever turned into the werewolf like in that Malfoy graveyard. Anyway, our nasty old house elf Weezer said what you said too, and I heard him talking to Dad when they thought that I was in bed, and he said, Weasel will report to the ministry that you had given the nasty little shapeshifter a wand. Oh, yes, Weasel will do it, and the ministry will know. And my dad said, fuck the ministry!
Well, perhaps you should not repeat everything your father says in private, Sneedle Snark suggested mildly.
He doesn't mind at all,
Teddy said loftily. Tony broke in. Well, Teddy darling, my little Turkish delight, this is simply too embarrassing, but, well, I cannot actually remember where it is we are going. Two bright pink spots appeared on Tony's cheeks.
We are going to the continent, Tony,
Teddy chirped.
I was showing you how to do the spell when I accidentally obliterated your memory. I cannot help it if I am brilliant with charms.
Tony wrung his hands in distress.
But why on earth would we be going to the continent? Oh, I do adore the continent, but the water, my little peanut pooper, I simply cannot bear the thought of all that water.
Teddy studied him with a thoughtful expression.
What is the last thing you remember, Tony?
Well, let me see. Yes, we're at that ghastly Muggle mansion so that you might visit Timothy. I remember that perfectly well. And then Elizabeth and her sister wished to go to the shops, he said distractedly. I'm certain I remember them discussing it, but that I remember nothing after that.
Teddy exhaled suddenly.
Nothing happened after that, Tony. Nothing at all, he said fervently. Nothing especially interesting. Me and Tim and Rosie and Henry and Kenny and you all read from the Looking Glass. I had a nap, and then you took me home, and Elizabeth wasn't there yet. So we had tea, and you talked about visiting the Prince of Transylvania. I guess Dad must have told the prince he has another gay vampire friend who's also super old and likes clothes and antiques and boring things. And then he must have showed the prince your picture, and he said he was most desperate to meet you.
Tony began trembling with excitement and clawed frantically at his throat.
Oh my. Nothing this exciting has happened to me in hundreds of years. Nothing this exciting has ever happened to me. The Prince of Transylvania, the most divinely attractive and swoon-worthy creature ever to strut the face of the earth, wished to meet me and invited me to his castle. I shall faint. I shall melt. My heart has stopped.
Your heart has already stopped, Tony.
Well, it may start again, yes, when I see him, and if he will, it shall start once more to beat again, when I feel the passion of true love. It has happened before, you know.
Oh, that is true,
Teddy said thoughtfully.
It has happened twice in the whole history of the world. A vampire so truly, madly, deeply in love that his heart actually started beating again. It was very well documented.
Teddy, my Teddy, how I adore you and all the world and every person and being in it!
Tony cried, sobbing joyfully into his orange silk handkerchief.
I'm simply beyond myself. This news about the prince and then how can I explain this sudden euphoria? It is as if a great and horrible weight has been lifted from my shoulders. It is as if I have awoken from a nightmare to the world's most superlatively fantabulizing dream. It is the grandest and most glorious mood swing that any bipolar vampire has ever enjoyed. Yes, I believe that I am so blissfully happy right now that I can face the channel!
I'm glad you are happy, Tony,
Teddy said sincerely.
And I must say, Teddy, I was ever so proud of that fantabulistic reading you performed, my talented little sugar lump. The fiendish scarlet worm. The audacious, immoral troll. I could picture it all quite vividly. So vividly in my...
He stood and pushed past Teddy and Sneedle Snark into the corridor, where he paused and very slowly brought a finger to his lips.
My imagination, he whispered, and began a slow pirouette on one toe. Hold your breath. Make a wish. Count to three.
Tony leapt three times, like a ballerina, his legs fully extended all the way to the end of the corridor and then twirled around, spinning in place like a top.
Come with me, and you'll be in a world of pure imagination.
He sang lustily, springing into a crouched position on the armrest beside the old lady with an eye patch. The old woman let out a shrill, startled cry and whacked him with her knitting, and he somersaulted backwards, landing in a gleeful plié in front of the thoroughly unimpressed ticket inspector.
Now I say, you must return to your...
We'll begin with a spin, traveling in the world of my creation.
He grabbed up the inspector's hands and they began to waltz.
Well, this is rather enjoyable.
The pair capered back down the aisle.
What we'll see...
When Tony and the ticket inspector whirled apart, they careered in opposite directions. And then Tony landed on his hands and knees in front of the tall young man.
We'll defy explanation.
Sort of, he replied impatiently. Like a bit of sleep tonight, yeah?
Tony held a finger over his lips to shush the fellow and dropped his voice to a low, thrilling tone.
If you want to view paradise, simply look around and view it. Anything you want, well, do it. Want to change the world? There's nothing to it.
No offense, mate, the man said briskly. But if you don't back off real quick, like, I'm going to bust that beak you got and kick you in the ghoulies.
Tony briskly trotted back to his seat and arranged himself with crossed legs and hands folded primly over one knee.
Now, Teddy darling, he twittered, perky talk show hostess style, do tell me what has been happening in your life. I absolutely must know all the gossip. Oh, do tell.
Teddy sat up straight, his hair winking from light brown to yellow.
Lots of things have happened in my life, Tony,
he chirped.
Well, maybe not lots of things. Last weekend I had a good time with my grandma Andromeda.
Tony smiled weakly at this.
Well, what did you two do together?
Well, not us two, us three,
Teddy clarified.
You know my Aunt Narcissa lives with her now. She's been very depressed because she lived in that cursed Malfoy house for so long, but the healer said it would go away after a while, and it finally has. She and Grandmother told silly stories and laughed a lot, and they cleared all the rubbish out of the cellar and made a special corner where they can do rituals with the dead.
Rituals? With the dead?
Tony twittered nervously.
My, how very interesting and not at all horrific.
They scattered ashes and chicken blood and drew lots of black circles on the floor and lit incense, and it was very fun and spooky. They even said I could help if I concentrated, because I'm black too and we are all good at necromancy. The first thing they did was try to conjure up Mum from the dead.
Were their efforts a success? Mr. Sneedlesnark said mildly.
Well... Not really. All they got were her eyebrows,
Teddy replied sadly.
But that's a start, and I can't wait to tell my dad about those death rituals they made me take the part in,
he squealed gleefully.
You wait and see what my dad will think about that, and he and grandmother will have a dreadful row and they will both lose their tempers. They will start shouting and using bad language and blasting spells at each other,
he finished ecstatically.
Well, it's good to have something to look forward to,
Teddy's new friend replied kindly. The Ten Bells had a portal, of course, and it was this that Lupin used to apparate to Spitalfields. The portal opened through the brick wall on the Fournier Street side of the building, which was poorly lit and somewhat sinister in the darkness, with the looming stone edifice of Christchurch beside it, and a half-dozen inebriated persons lolling about on the curb. He walked past the hair salon, a disused office flat, and then the door of number 5, where two women with an alarming number of packages were unsuccessfully attempting to gain entrance by taking it in turn to try this key and that lock to the right, and then that key and this lock to the left, before desperately trying it all again in reverse order. Lupin gave the door a glance, and it swung open immediately, spilling them into a darkened corridor. Two exclamations of delight followed, a pause, and then a distinctly American accent wailed,
"Shit! We forgot to leave the lights on again!"
A few doors further on, he looked left down Wilkes Street, where police cars were parked on curbs, and two uniformed officers stood in front of a bulky, cloth-covered object pushed up against a brick wall. Apparently, they were guarding the corpse, Lupin thought, to ensure that it did not escape. 200 yards before he even reached the crime scene, Tony's ancient orange handkerchief spiraled up towards a tree branch, the scent of his cologne wafting through the air, and Lupin had solved the case. His first thought might have pleased Tony. It certainly would have pleased Radu, and it would have infuriated Shacklebolt.
Don't worry, Tony. I won't let the humans hurt you.